I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, was it a hoax or wasn't it? That's the question on everyone's mind today in the wake of a high-altitude, high-anxiety drama in the skies over Colorado yesterday. The Larimer County Sheriff's Department now says officials will re-interview the Heaney family of Fort Collins to find out exactly what did happen when a homemade balloon took off, and at the time, the family said their 6-year-old son, Falcon, was stuck inside it. But it turns out he was hiding in the garage attic the whole time. Last night, CNN's Wolf Blitzer asked why the boy stayed hidden, even though he heard people calling his name. Here's what Falcon said.
You guys said that we did this for the show.
That was 6-year-old Falcon Heaney saying, quote, "We did it for the show." His father, Richard, says he doesn't know why his son said that and that he may not have understood the question. Michelle Griego is with CBS 4 in Denver, and she's covering the story. And Michelle, this morning on the Today Show, Falcon got sick, vomiting into a bowl, while his father was responding to the same question, whether or not this was a hoax. This was the second time that's happened. And this has become a media circus, but what are officials saying? Do they actually believe what happened?
Well, what officials are saying, well, the Larimer County Sheriff, Jim Alderton, did say this morning is that they are going to re-interview the Heaney family. But he did say that his sheriff's deputies who were with the family yesterday when all of this was going on, they are trained professionals. They're trained to watch body language. They're trained to watch reactions when things like this happen or when a child disappears or there's an accident. They're trained to watch that. And he said that the sheriff's deputies were confident that this was legitimate, that they had normal reactions that any parent would to think that their kid was put in danger. And they believe at the time that the parents did not know where this kid was. But there certainly is speculation, especially because of this interview that was aired on CNN and with Falcon saying that he was doing it for the show, and also their previous media experience. You know, they were on Wife Swap, and they have some videos on YouTube, and now this new home video is released of the launch. So there certainly is speculation, and I believe that that's why Larimer County Sheriff's deputies will be re-interviewing the family today.
So with all this media speculation and the Heaney family's experience with media, you said there's this video of the launch actually happening. It turns out the family was there. What are people saying about that aspect of this whole story?
Well, it was a planned launch. Apparently the family, they were going to experiment with this helium balloon. They wanted to launch it at least 20 feet up just to see if it would sort of hover above the ground. And somehow the tether got loose, and that's how it all came apart. If you see the video, you hear both Richard Heaney and his wife screaming as it becomes loose and the balloon goes up. I believe one of their children, they have three children, one of them was videotaping the whole thing, and they're screaming, and Richard Heaney is upset, and he's yelling. We never heard them yell Falcon, or I don't know if they believe that Falcon was in the balloon at the time, but you can visibly tell they were upset. In fact, I think Richard Heaney at one point grabbed his hair and kicked a wood structure that was in his backyard.
And Michelle, how are people there in Colorado reacting to this whole story?
You know, a lot of people are speculating. They're wondering if this is a hoax or not. And then you think about taxpayers as well. Those are the people probably footing the bill. More than 200 people went out looking for Falcon Heaney yesterday. The cost of this could be, you know, in the tens of thousands of dollars. But officials do say that, you know, most of the work that was being done, it was being done by public safety officers, which are paramedics and firefighters. They're already being paid to do their jobs.
And that cost includes the cost of the National Guard being activated.
When the Colorado National Guard, they brought out a Black Hawk helicopter, and they may have brought out multiple ones. The cost for that is about $4,600 an hour.
So there's this great cost, and the Sheriff's Department is going to re-interview the family. So is there any possibility that charges will be brought or the family will be asked to pay for the cost of trying to find their son who wasn't missing in the first place?
Well, right now, if officials do not believe that it's a hoax, right now, the family will not be asked to pay for the cost, because that's, you know, what officials are saying, that these are public safety officers, these are what taxpayers pay them for, so they will not have to foot the bill on that. Now, if it does turn out to be a hoax after this investigation is done, then there are some criminal elements to this.
Michelle Griego is with CBS 4 in Denver. Michelle, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on this story.
Okay, no problem.
And now a story about another little boy's harrowing, albeit fictional, adventure.
You are now the king, and you will be a truly great king.
Hey, King, what's your first order of business?
It's the Wild Rumpista!
Perfect answer!
Everyone knows Max, the boy in the wolf suit, who feels misunderstood at home and escapes to an island where the wild things are. Author and illustrator Maurice Sendak handpicked Spike Jonze to direct Where the Wild Things Are, hoping that the man behind movies such as Adaptation and Being John Malkovich would put the teeth back into Sendak's book, which, we might forget today, first alarmed adults back in 1963. Where the Wild Things Are opens in theaters today. When Newsweek magazine asked Sendak what he would say to parents who might think the film too scary for children, Sendak said, quote, "If they can't handle it, go home. It's not a question that can be answered."
There will be controversy about this, but the film has an entire emotional, spiritual, visual life, which is as valid as the book.
It turns out, though, that the film has been tamed somewhat. Some scenes were reshot or left on the cutting room floor. Well, on this Friday, we'd like to take some time to listen back to our June 2008 interview with Maurice Sendak, who had just turned 80, and who remains unapologetic about the dark side in his children's tales. Here and Now host Robin Young began by telling Sendak that she loved his answering machine message, which greeted callers with a gruff, "If you're in a hurry, go away."
Yes, because everyone, mostly when they're calling from New York, toe-tapping with impatience. So I give them plenty of warning to go away. If they don't have anything important to say, just scram, because I'm not going to run.
No, because at 80, why should you?
Exactly.
Your thoughts on turning 80?
It is the strangest feeling that I could have leaped to 80. It just was too fast.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that happen along the way. Let's stay a little with Where the Wild Things Are. The little boy Max we met, the forest grows in his room, he sails a boat, meets the wild things, who, by the way, don't look very wild to me, tames them with a trick of looking into their yellow eyes. Where did that come from?
Well, that comes from our relatives. All the wild things are relatives who were brought over by my parents during World War II, when they were trying to get Jewish people out of Europe. And these are the ones in my mother's family, because that's what my father thought appropriate. And he got most of her siblings out and her mother, but that was it. And when he turned to his own family, they were gone.
Oh. Well, how much of the storytelling is about that, you know, about taming the monsters by looking in their eyes?
Well, yes, I have never claimed to be a writer of children's books. I wrote honestly. I wrote about my life. I wrote about what was happening. There were many bleak, dark moments. I wanted to be very, very honest. I also knew that the worst thing you could do to children is lie. And not appreciate the fact that the truth, no matter how painful, is more acceptable to them than some nonsense story. And I've gotten in trouble over that in terms of some of the books I did. Some people thought the wild things were too frightening. I've tried not to care about that because, as I said, I didn't set myself out to write books for children or to make life easier or charming or funny. If it is, it is, and sometimes it is funny. But I'm a writer and an illustrator, and I take my work seriously.
Should we look for these references and other stories? For instance, you know, I'm thinking of Mickey, the little boy in the night kitchen, a personal favorite, falls out of bed, as we said, past his mom, into the cake batter in the night kitchen. But I can't help but notice now that he narrowly escapes the oven. You know, he was going to be baked.
And you got it.
Oh, really?
You got it. And did you notice the bakers have little Hitler mustachios?
I do now.
Yep.
Yeah. And he makes his way out by making a plane out of bread dough. Now that breaks my heart.
You know? Well, don't let it break your heart. Continue to enjoy the book, but I think it thickens and makes more profound, if I dare use that word, the work in hand, that it comes from those sources. I grew up during all of that. I was born just at the beginning of it, and I had to see what sufferings my parents went through. It was not to be believed.
Yeah. Your biographer, the playwright Tony Kushner, talks about that, and I want to hear, you know, what he has to say about your writing. But speaking of Tony Kushner, now it can be told. If anyone's seen Angels in America, there is that scene with three rabbis, and it's
right.
Tony Kushner, Meryl Streep, and you.
It is me, indeed.
Let's remind ourselves, a young gay man whose partner has AIDS asks the rabbi, played by Meryl Streep, what the Holy Writ has to say about someone who leaves a loved one at a time of great need. Here is the response from Meryl Streep as a rabbi in the film.
The Holy Scripture has nothing to say about such a person.
Rabbi, I'm afraid of the crimes I may commit.
Please, mister, I'm a sick old rabbi facing a long ride home to the Bronx. If you want to confess, better you should find a priest.
What was that like?
Oh, it was hilarious because, of course, I had no idea it was her. I thought it was a man. And, I mean, it was testing out. They wanted to see, could she really be the one to do this? And, of course, she was remarkably successful, if detestable. And I was ready to just punch her out, or rather punch him out, because I thought it was a man.
And even if it was a rabbi, you were going to...
I'm always ready.
Well, anyway, there the three of you are in that scene. It's just delightful. But Tony Kushner, you've collaborated with him on Brundibar,
yes.
The children's book and opera about two kids who overcome an organ grinder bully, more shades of Hitler.
Right.
Well, he writes that you suffer a book. Rather than write one, you suffer a book.
I think under pressure he would have to admit that he suffers a play.
Yeah, but yours are supposed to be children's books, but you've revealed to us what you know, part of what you're bringing to the table. And we understand, you know, so hard at times that you actually suffered a nervous breakdown doing Outside Over There.
Correct.
Why? What was...
I don't know. The book was of an extremely personal nature. My sister was in it. Mozart was in it. Important people in my life were in that book. And it brought me low. It brought me low because it probably touched on very deep unconscious things that the artist, of course, is always struggling to bring up.
Yeah.
And put down on paper and solve and win.
We'll have more of Robin Young's conversation with Maurice Sendak after a break. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're listening to Robin Young's June 2008 conversation with Maurice Sendak, author and illustrator of Where the Wild Things Are. Sendak had just turned 80 when Robin spoke with him, and she was surprised to learn how much the Holocaust informs many of Sendak's award-winning children's books, such as the 1981 dark fairy tale Outside Over There. It's laid out like a children's storybook with beautiful illustrations, but it tells the story of a baby who gets kidnapped by goblins and how her big sister Ida must go rescue her. Robin asked Sendak if the story referred to his own family. His mother's siblings survived the Holocaust, but his father wasn't able to rescue his own family from the Nazis.
Yeah. See, that was always an immensely fascinating place for me, because that's where they came from. They did get my grandmother. The only grandparent I have is my mother's mother. And the stories she told were so frightening, were so chilling. Jewish people in tiny villages where nobody wanted them. And so they were not the cheerful stories. I didn't grow up on Robin Hood. I didn't grow up on Oz. So to be sad and quiet I'm afraid, was what childhood was like.
Well, and then you add to that, you say it was in part inspired by the 1932 Lindbergh baby kidnapping, which probably terrified a lot of children.
Oh, well, correct. I mean, that was just about the worst that could happen. And so there was no way that childhood could be some Winnie the Pooh nonsense.
Yeah.
Unless you happen to be fortunate enough to be Christopher Robin. Fate put me where it put me, and it put a lot of kids in much worse conditions than I was in. But it leaves this big, fat handprint on you.
Yeah. Well, we rush to say, too, that if you don't read it with that backstory, I mean, even if you do, I mean, we have so much fun in the night kitchen, you know, making dough into an airplane and falling in a milk bottle.
Well, you see, it's a funny idea. I loved it. I thought it was such a funny idea. And it made me remember my mother, who made marvelous cookies, and they came out all different shapes. That the other things creep in is something I can't prevent.
And when I see Where the Wild Things Are today, I see Shrek. I see, what was that, Monsters,
yes,
Inc., where the little,
yes,
boy goes through the wall? I see all of those monsters that aren't really monsters.
Well, I think I can say this honestly without sounding vain. You wouldn't have seen them pre-Wild Things.
Yeah.
Wild Things did break the wall. It did come out and say there were such things as nightmares and creatures that children had to contend with, that adults have to contend with. And yet, I don't want to make light of that fear, because how could we not be fearful for our children? So even if sometimes, you know, I get annoyed that somebody thinks something of mine is too frightening for their kid, well, then I always just tell them, don't read it. Because some things are, and there are some who just will be frightened at anything. Often they change those conclusions later. It's nice. In the old days when I would be at college and some person would shake my hand firmly and say, boy, that book really scared me as a kid, but I just love it now. And that's great. That's what art is. We learn. We learn.
Let me ask you about the illustrations, because we're reading a book right now, Leonard Marcus's new book about children's literature called Minders of Make-Believe.
Yeah.
Yep. He says, you're the inheritor of the romantic visionary tradition that goes back to William Blake in the, you know, 19th century. And others have said, oh, my gosh, it's modern artist Rousseau and Picasso and Joseph Cornell and Andy Warhol and Mickey Mouse.
I get a joy for William Blake. But I also get a joy, which is probably the greatest joy I had as a child, was Mickey Mouse. And the sight of him on the screen, and I remember my sister telling me this, she said, because there was always a double feature, and in the middle was a Mickey Mouse cartoon. And she says, when we got to the cartoon, I practically had to sit on you because you went berserk. And I think just the colors on his body, the fun of it all. There was very little to be happy about back then, and Mickey was it. Mickey was the clown that never failed to make me laugh, and physically was so beautiful because graphically he was so well done, and the colors chosen for him were so yummy. In every way, he was superb.
And he was also scary. Remember Sorcerer's Apprentice?
Oh, well, yeah.
The brooms multiplying and the water coming and he couldn't,
yes,
get rid of it?
No, he wasn't the coward.
Yeah, yeah. He was heroic.
And that's probably why he won over so many children who would have been afraid to have gone through some of those.
Is that part of, do you want your kids to, you know, be heroic?
Yes.
Win.
You want them to be honest. Yeah. I don't do books specifically for children to teach them anything. So if you can translate that, then it could only mean I just don't want to lie to them. Even if it verges on the scary, even if it verges on subject matter, which there are parents and librarians who will say, not appropriate.
Well, they obviously haven't noticed your descendants, including Harry Potter.
That's true. Now look at all the troubles that he gets into. But you see, I have been around for so long. And I've been the beating up boy for scary books. So that now, of course, you can get away with so many things. But I'm not going to worry about that. I'm not going to worry about that because I'm just turning this ridiculous age. I want to live as long as I can. I want to produce important books.
Hmm. Maurice Sendak, one last question. Do you look under the bed at night?
No.
No.
Well, sometimes I do because I live in the country and I do for ticks.
Actually, ticks can be dangerous.
That's Here and Now's Robin Young talking with author Maurice Sendak back in June of 2008. The film based on Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are opens in theaters today. Back after the news, Here and Now. Well, as we've heard, the Obama administration continues debating whether to send an additional 40,000 troops to Afghanistan. We're already spending $3.6 billion a month there, and as the Obama administration, we find, is being guided by a new breakdown about how much it might cost to send at least one additional soldier or one Marine to Afghanistan each year. Joining us on the line is Roxana Tiron. She's defense correspondent for The Hill newspaper in Washington. And Roxana, what is that breakdown, that number?
Lawmakers have started asking the question because the Obama administration is using $1 billion per 1,000 troops per year. So that would come out to $1 million per soldier or per Marine. And they're trying to find out what goes into that. They're trying to find out the breakdown of what goes into those numbers. Usually personnel costs are the highest and operation and maintenance costs during a war. So they wanted to find out what goes into the cost so that they can calculate and anticipate.
And those costs that you mentioned also include things like equipment, food, transports, all the logistical necessities of running a very complex war operation in Afghanistan. And Congressman John Murtha of Pennsylvania, he began asking questions about that number, as you report, that $1 million per soldier per year. We recall that he is the chair of the House Appropriations Defense Panel. And you found that there was one thing in particular that really jumped out at him. What was that?
They got a number, on average, $400 per gallon of fuel.
$400 per gallon of gasoline.
Well, or JP-8
fuel, okay.
Which the military uses. But that jumped out at him the most, and his staff, of course, the appropriations staff, is working on that, trying to get answers as to why it costs so much. But we need to be very clear on that number. The military uses a very arcane term called the fully burdened costs of fuel. The military tries to get their fuel from refineries and wholesalers, you know, as close as possible to where, you know, to where they're operating. And it's not necessarily just the fuel itself, which is being sold to the military at $2.78. It's everything else that gets into getting that gallon of fuel to the soldiers.
And so what are those things that are required to get the fuel out there?
Everything from shipping the fuel to picking it up to securing it. A lot of it, and this was an issue in Iraq as well, a lot of it is securing it, the security convoys. And a lot of it is the fact that there's a lot of very inaccessible places in Afghanistan, forward operating bases, that sometimes cannot be resupplied by truck. And well, so they have to be flown. And flying everything is, of course, very expensive. Or if you have to fly only by helicopter, or Chinook helicopters can fly in some areas, that then again you can't carry enough, so it just adds up to the cost.
And you report, and regarding those helicopters, that oftentimes the gasoline, or the fuel, I should say, needs to be loaded into these bladders and flown over the Afghan mountains. And here's a country that's landlocked. It's not very easy.
Exactly. It's not even just for the mobility. It's everything else, light in the tents, everything, generators.
So in the very extreme weather of Afghanistan, running the air conditioners or the heaters, keeping soldiers comfortable, costs. And you also remind us that, according to at least one report, Marines right now, United States Marines, are using 800,000 gallons of fuel a day in the Afghan theater there. So it's a huge amount. At $400 a gallon, what was Congressman Murtha's reaction to these numbers?
his reaction was that it was very worrisome. We're looking into it. We're trying to understand why. Congressman Mirtha has sort of predicted that there's going to be another emergency war supplemental on top of the 2010 budget. And Congressman Mirtha didn't give the indication that he was going to push back on war funding. He has actually said publicly that he would, you know, he would work on a supplemental if one is needed. But I think he did express some sticker shock because it's a number that if you just hear it like this, it's a number then that you start calculating and start adding up, and as someone who holds the, you know, the purse strings, I think he's starting to wonder what goes into everything.
Roxana Tiron is defense reporter for The Hill. Roxana, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, the final chapter in our 5 farm series, an organic farm in California. It's Here and Now. All week long, we've been profiling American farmers and their prospects for the future in our series, 5 Farms. Our final stop, just northwest of Sacramento in Yolo County, California. That's where Jeff and Annie Main are working to preserve their 20-acre organic farm, Good Humus Produce. The Mains started the farm 24 years ago on an idle piece of land just as they were starting their family. They now have 3 grown children, and not one of them has plans to take over the family farm. Our story was produced by John Bewin and Ben Alder.
Well, this 2.5 acres, half this field, we planted 24 years ago. Peach trees generally, because they're such huge producers, only last, their lifespan is around 20 years. So these trees are on the edge of their whole life cycle. They're actually not looking too bad. I mean, some of them, they've had to cut some large branches out, but they're looking pretty good.
Within a few years, a maximum of 10, you know, more than likely these trees will all be gone. We're in a process now of getting what we can off of them, which is substantial still, but watching a slow decline. So we have planted a new orchard, a new 1 acre block to replace this one.
I think what's really interesting about most farms, this farm, is it's definitely not a mature farm. So we'd like 20 more acres, like a 40 acre farm. We'd like animals, you know, cows, and you know, that rotation. We haven't been able to bring that rotation into it, but I'm not sure that we can do that.
The future of farms like this is really precarious because they're very, very small. They're not protected by the standard legal system that protects farmland. We are much more valuable to somebody who would like to spend a little bit of money, have some horses running in paddocks or something, but not providing food for people.
I mean, there was a point probably year 20 where I did lose hope. And I thought, why are we doing this? I'm exhausted. It's not, certainly not a monetary reason why we're doing this. It's not, is it appreciated? I'm not sure. I saw all my farming women friends exhausted. And the whole question of sustainability. Well, what is sustainable? You know, you talk about sustainable soil and, you know, all these aspects, but how do we sustain us? And I think, you know, that's how we came to the whole farm preservation project and the future of this farm and how to pass it on.
So what we've done personally has been to create an easement, and we're in the final stages of writing that. It's a legal document that packages up a portion of the rights of ownership of a piece of land and sells them as a separate unit. In this case, it'd be to a public land trust. It assures that the next person that comes to live on this farm will be producing food for people and will be capable of doing that.
When we started that project, then I said, okay, I can keep going because it's not just for us, it's not just for now, it's for the next generation that'll carry this on. And it was a huge shift in that I said, okay, I'll go another 25 years, you know, I can do that.
Hi, Mary.
How are you?
Good.
Good to see you.
It's Annie Main. We're at Good Humus, and we're at the August 2nd. We always have a peach party the first weekend in August.
There's, I don't know, probably 100 people around here milling around the yard, eating Greek lamb.
Does it look all right? Did you test one?
And drinking homemade root beer, fresh squeezed apple cider, and some soda, some beer.
Homemade ice cream, where there's going to be a peach sorbet ice cream. We had homemade peach salsa, but then everything else is potluck.
A verbal picture would be strings of white lights all around this central yard area, which is surrounded by trees. It's surrounded by our flowering crabapple, our
lilacs,
the
willow tree,
the original grandmother nectarine tree is there.
And all sorts of community members from our CSA. People have come from San Francisco, from Sacramento, from Davis, and then the farming community. You know, sort of a moment to celebrate the harvest.
The real theme that runs through Good Humus Produce is community, is the creation of community. And we never realized that that's what this was all about.
We're gonna do the grace after dinner and before dessert.
Yay!
Make a little circle
around the cedar tree here.
Okay.
I think Paul has something to say.
Pass around grace, where we all say, "What a wonderful and amazing place that's been created here that Jeff and Annie have done." This was bare land years ago when they first came here, not a tree in sight, and look at it now. Look what they've done. They've not only made community, they've made shade for that community to rest in and eat in and enjoy one another's company. They are visionaries, and we love them very much.
I'd like to say thank you to all the people here. I'd like to recognize that this is like the 15th or 16th time that we've gotten together like this, and some of you have been at every single one of those. And it's a really, to us, it's an incredible experience to begin to understand how much we are supported. This farm is supported. I say this almost every year, but every year it becomes more and more evident to us that without all of you, without this, we wouldn't be here. We would not be able to do this. You people are so special. And the fact that you come here tonight is something that we'll always remember through the years. Thank you very much.
Yay!
Okay, back to wherever you were.
Now the pies can come out to the table and you have permission to eat dessert.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead and eat Greek lamb if you'd like. You can go ahead and have some salsa.
Jeff and Annie Main and friends at the Main's Farm in Yolo County, California. Five Farms is a production of Wesley Horner Productions and the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. To learn more about the families in this series, view photo essays of the farmers, their families, and their farms, and listen to extended audio, go to our website, hereandnow.org. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Everyone's talking slab, but nobody knows. Till you have stared down the barrel.
The fact that you're even hearing this song is a bit hard to believe because in 2008, the singer, Will Hoag, nearly died in a Nashville traffic accident when an oncoming van plowed into his scooter. After months of surgery and rehab, he was finally able to pick up his guitar and go back to work. The result is a new CD called The Wrecking.
More than diamonds and gold when it's hard.
still limping a bit, Will Hoag is back on the road. And before a recent show in Boston, he spoke to Here and Now's Alex Ashlock on his tour bus.
Now, the name of the CD is The Wreckage. Should we read that literally based on what happened to you?
I think it's hard not to. I don't think it was a total literal interpretation. When you go through something like that, everything is kind of reflective of the event. So, I mean, it has to be in there at some point, I think.
Were you working on this particular record when you had the accident?
We had been in the studio, yes, for about 10 days, and we had done 4 or 5 songs. And then on the way home when all of this went down, took about 10 months off, and then went back and started working again and finished up some of the songs that we had recorded before. We ditched some of the songs that we had recorded before. They didn't really stand up to what we felt like some of the new stuff that had been written seemed to be a little fresher. And there were some things that certainly made the record that weren't there originally.
How did we end up here? How did everything good just disappear? How could I change something I don't know? You say that this ain't a game. You say that you think I won't ever change. You say I learned my lessons far too slow.
Was there a time when you were recovering and you were really badly injured and really laid up for many months? I think you said 10 months. Is there a time when you were thinking, boy, I'm not going to be able to get back to doing what I love to do?
You know, there wasn't. It was real strange. It was the only time in the 12 years that I've done this for a living that this wasn't really a focus. You know, and people would say that. People would come to the hospital and say, you know, I know that you must be dying to, you know, to get back on the road, get back to playing. And, you know, the quote was, I caught myself saying all the time, you know, I'm just ready to get back to walking. You know, that was it. It was the first time that music had not been the main focus of my life, and to be, you know, without holding a guitar for 4.5 months is something that I've never done. And I think that was part of the recovery process for me, was knowing that I needed something to work towards, and this was certainly it, finishing this record and all those things.
Tell me a little bit about how you got to the point where you were in 2008 when you had the accident. Was being a musician performing something that you had always wanted to do?
Music is something I fell in love with real young. My grandfather was a big band musician in Nashville in the 40s. My dad was a sort of post-Beatlemania kid, so he was in rock bands in the late 50s and early 60s through the time that he got married and had kids, as was his brother, my uncle. So, you know, music was something that I kind of came into naturally and inherited a really great record collection and a really just fond love of music. So it was always around, but more from a fan's perspective than a performer's perspective or anything like that. It wasn't like I grew up doing anything very musical. I grew up just kind of a normal kid upbringing, playing sports and things like that. And then, you know, as I was always falling in love more and more with music, then my last year of high school, I bought a guitar from my best friend's father and just started teaching myself chords and things like that, so it really didn't come on much until college, and then it was downhill fast from there.
And you obviously still love it, because you worked really hard to get back to where you are now.
Yeah, and it's really all I know. It's kind of one of those things, it's that true kind of love, I think, that you don't find in a lot of people in your life or in a lot of situations, job-wise or friend-wise or anything like that. It really is one of those things that I felt like real early on, the more that I could put into it, it kind of gave back to me. And it's one of those things that over, like I said, a 12-year period of doing this and making a living doing this, it's strange when you kind of look around, because it starts with just this kind of childish dream. You just want to start a band and play music with your friends. You don't really think about it a whole lot bigger than that, I don't think. You want to write songs and try to be better at your job. And then all of a sudden, you know, you look and you've bought a house because of rock and roll, and you've met a woman and, you know, fallen in love and gotten married because of rock and roll. You've had a kid, and it kind of all comes back to rock and roll, which is either really, really cool or really, really sad, depending on your perspective, I suppose.
Time passes by and leaves start to fade, and I'm all alone here wishing I'd change. Photographs and candles, bottles of wine, just can't bring back one moment of time.
You sit around, I'm sure, and play your guitar all the time. Is there a song you like to play that maybe isn't a song you wrote?
One that stands out, you know, right after the accident, when I was able to get back home and was still in a wheelchair, and it was the first time that I was able to even hold a guitar, you know, in my lap. I couldn't stand but and couldn't hold a strap or anything, but I finally had enough strength in my arms to sit and try to play a little bit. And the first thing that I played was an old Stanley Brothers song called Angel Band. That was the first moment. You asked me earlier if I thought that I would, if there was a point that I never thought, you know, thought I'd never do this again, and there wasn't. But there was a point, and that was the point for me when I realized that I would do it again. I never questioned that I would, but it was just enough of what I knew that I was able to do beforehand, playing-wise and singing-wise. Especially musically, it may have been the first time that I really took a deep breath and realized, like, okay, it is going to be okay. It's not just me telling myself it's going to be okay. And so that song will always hold a real special place for me.
Will Hoag's new CD is called The Wreckage. He spoke with Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.